Welcome. The following presentation from Answers in CME is part of an educational activity titled Shingles Prevention Strategies in Immune-Mediated Diseases. To access the full program and supporting materials, visit www.answersincme.com/QNV860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from GlaxoSmithKline.
Welcome. This is Dr. Len Calabrese. I'm a professor of medicine at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine and the head of the R.J. Fiesenmeyer Center for Clinical Immunology. And I'm going to talk to you about the problem of varicella zoster infection. It's a very common opportunistic infection. It occurs over 1 million times in the United States, and the clinical sequelae of it are profound for those people most seriously afflicted. The most feared complication of this is postherpetic neuralgia. This is a syndrome of pain that endures after the lesion has resolved. It occurs in about 1 of 5 patients. Age is the greatest risk factor. When it is severe, the pain can be constant, burning, aching, throbbing, and present a true therapeutic challenge for pain management. It can also be intermittent, and at times it can have allodynic features as well. Another major complication of zoster that we fear is when it involves the trigeminal nerve. Here you can see an image of a patient with a V2 distribution. The arrow is pointing to the so-called Huntington side that reflect a high risk of ocular involvement. Ocular involvement with zoster ophthalmicus is a medical emergency and requires the intervention of a skilled ophthalmologist and prompt antiviral therapy, and often hospitalization because vision can be lost. More recently, another spectrum of complications has been reported, and that is cardiovascular complications. Both stroke and myocardial infarction are increased in their incidence after zoster. Stroke is most frequently increased when the distribution is of zoster of the head and neck. Myocardial infarction, there is no anatomic predisposition. The relative risk goes up, particularly within the first several months after zoster, and gradually subsides over 1 year. We were the first to assess the risk of stroke in patients with immune-mediated inflammatory diseases. Those of us who take care of IMIDS patients who see a greater frequency of herpes zoster need to be aware of this complication. In the next session, we'll discuss the primary risk factors for shingles, including age-related decline in immunity and immunocompromising conditions, and evaluate the risk of shingles associated with immunosuppressive therapy. Herpes zoster is an infection that we have nearly a 1 in 2 chance of acquiring if we live to be 80 years of age. As you can see from this graphic, age is one of the most profound risk factors for developing zoster. It is relatively uncommon, but well documented in people younger than 30. And after about the age of 50, the graph clearly takes off, showing increasing incidence as we age. While age is a major risk factor for zoster, the association with immunosuppressive illnesses is even more profound. And that is probably related to therapies as well as underlying immunoperturbations. The rate of zoster is increased by 1.5 to 2.0 times as much in patients with immune-mediated diseases than healthy age-matched and sex-matched controls. In rheumatoid arthritis, variables regarding the disease itself have been assessed in numerous studies, including this high-impact study from the Corona Registry. Not surprisingly, age, higher glucocorticoids, and a history of exposure to more than 2 biologics, as well as uncontrolled disease activity, all contribute to increased risk. In terms of specific biologics, while there is some debate as to whether anti-cytokine therapy palpably contribute to the risk of zoster, there is no debate that the single class of drugs that pose the greatest enhanced risk are Janus kinase inhibitors. And these risks are commensurate with shingles incidence that we used to see in the pre-antiretroviral HIV era. So for those of us using JAK inhibitors on the increasing number of indications, this is one of the most important factors that we need to ferret in as we develop our preventive strategies. So in conclusion, when assessing risk in patients with immune-mediated inflammatory diseases, age and immunosuppressive therapies are the two major factors that we need to include in this analysis. And of those, therapy, particularly with Janus kinase inhibitors, appear to be the greatest risk. In the next session, we'll discuss the current ACIP recommendations for shingles vaccination in patients with immune-mediated diseases. We'll also consider whether patients who have previously received the live zoster vaccine are eligible to receive the more recently approved recombinant zoster vaccine. In 2006, the live zoster vaccine was introduced and was a major step forward in prevention. This was problematic for patients with immunosuppressive illnesses since it was a live vaccine. And as it turned out, its efficacy waned in older age groups and decreased over time. In 2017, the recombinant zoster vaccine was introduced, and this really revolutionized prevention of this feared complication. The recombinant zoster vaccine is now recommended for the prevention of zoster and related complications for immunocompetent adults over the age of 50, and is recommended for prevention of zoster and related complications for immunocompetent adults who previously received live zoster vaccine. And this same vaccine is preferred over the live vaccine for prevention of zoster and related complications. In fact, live zoster vaccine is not currently available in the United States. For the immunocompromised population, our patients are the most vulnerable to zoster. And most institutions and most organizations consider the use of recombinant zoster vaccine as a standard of care to prevent shingles in this population. In our clinical immunology clinic, we recommend it for all patients at the highest risk, particularly of those on JAK inhibitors. In 2018, updates to the immunization schedule informed us that two doses of this vaccine, given at baseline and then 2 to 6 months apart, is the preferred regimen. For those that never get the second vaccine, we do not restart the cycle. We give it to them when they can. There is no current recommendations on the use of recombinant zoster in pregnant women or adults with immunocompromising conditions. But among communities that care for such patients, this has been a major step ahead. In summary, immunization is the preferred strategy for zoster prevention. While we want to treat zoster promptly to hasten healing and reduce long-term complications, an ounce of prevention is by far the superior strategy. In our next session, we'll evaluate the efficacy of recombinant zoster vaccine in preventing shingles in patients with immune-mediated inflammatory diseases. In this segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about efficacy of the recombinant zoster vaccine in our patients with immune-mediated inflammatory diseases. This graphic, which shows the pooled post-hoc analysis of the pivotal trials, show that the vaccine efficacy overall was 90% or higher. And what is really impressive is that if you look at the age epochs, the recombinant zoster vaccine had very little fall-off even in patients over 80 years of age, which is a great improvement over the previous live version. In this graphic, we show the prevention of postherpetic neuralgia in a non-immunocompromised population. And again, for recombinant zoster vaccine, the only vaccine that we have available in the United States, the efficacy is in between 88 and 91%. We have to extrapolate that this is effective in immunosuppressed patients, but our clinical assessment after using this for several years is that it is probably equally effective. In the United States, we only have recombinant zoster vaccine available to us, but throughout the world, live zoster vaccine is still used, though country by country is moving to the recombinant zoster vaccine as we speak. The recombinant zoster vaccine has been shown to be more effective with a better safety signal than live zoster vaccine in immunosuppressed patients. While we don't have a lot of data on prevention of postherpetic neuralgia at this time, we know that it is a highly efficacious strategy. Probably the biggest challenge is timing of this vaccine. The best time to immunize anyone who is going on immunosuppressive therapy is beforehand. This was particularly problematic with patients getting live vaccine, but with the recombinant vaccine, you can start this vaccine at least 1 to 2 weeks prior to starting immunosuppressive regimens. We believe that this optimizes the best chance for response. In our next session, we'll discuss strategies to improve patient education and adherence on the uptake of shingles vaccinations and understanding the safety profile of the vaccine. In this segment, we're going to talk about adverse events and safety data from recombinant zoster vaccine. When we give recombinant zoster vaccine, there is a high incidence of side effects, which are relatively mild and manageable in the vast majority of patients. This mostly relates to pain, redness, and swelling. Some patients can get fever and myalgia. In practical terms, we like to tell patients, don't plan this if you have a big engagement. There has been post-licensure safety surveillance of recombinant zoster vaccine. And overall, while reactogenicity is high, the number of serious reports per 100,000 is quite small and actually commensurate to the live zoster vaccine. Serious adverse events are actually less with recombinant zoster vaccine than with the live previous version of zoster vaccine. Finally, there's a lot of questions about, will this vaccine flare my underlying immune-mediated inflammatory disease? The largest study to date is from our center, where we examined over 600 patients in a rheumatology practice that had received recombinant zoster vaccine, and basically showed that the rate of flares is about 16% in the 12 weeks after immunization. Most of these flares were minor. Risk factors for flares included being on glucocorticoids at the time of vaccination and having a flare from the first vaccine predicted a flare from the second vaccine. The gains from being vaccinated to prevent zoster and zoster-related complications outweigh these types of concerns. The final point I'd like to make is addressing common questions from patients. Doc, I've already had shingles. Recombinant zoster vaccine is recommended regardless whether a person has had a history of previous zoster. So I usually wait to at least 1 year. What about, I've already been vaccinated. I had that shingles vaccine a decade ago. Recombinant zoster vaccine is now the preferred vaccine, even for patients who have been previously immunized with the live version in the past. These are just a couple things that I hear in my practice. I'm sure you have others. You can reach out to me through my email or through Twitter if you want to talk about them with me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please visit www.answersincme.com/QNV860 to view all program materials, complete the post test, and get a certificate.